Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Scott McClellan, who served as a White House press secretary from 2003 to 2006. We'll be talking to him about his new book, What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. We'll talk about the culture of deception and the permanent campaign. Of course, we are in the midst of a presidential campaign at this moment. And then we'll talk about the outsourcing of the intelligence business. We hear a lot about the outsourcing of military, et cetera, through Halliburton and other companies, but little is discussed about the outsourcing of intelligence. We'll talk to Tim Shorrock, who's got a new book, Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. And then, given that diplomacy appears to be breaking out all over the place, we'll talk with Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who's a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, has also been the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, a distinguished fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies, and a director of Chinese affairs for the Department of State, among other positions. He also served as an advisor to the Iraq Study Group. I'm now speaking with Scott McClellan, again the author of What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. Scott McClellan served as a White House press secretary from 2003 to 2006. Before that, he served as a principal deputy White House press secretary and as the traveling press secretary for the Bush-Cheney 2000 campaign. Early in his career, Scott McClellan served as a deputy communications director in the Texas governor's office and campaign managers for three successful statewide campaigns. He's now a senior advisor to a global technology firm and a communications strategist. And, of course, his best-selling book, controversial as it is, What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. So, Scott McClellan, I get the impression that we're in an era where the truth is a moving target. Whoever spends the truth best wins the day. And we also have this new phenomenon now in our culture, not just our political culture, the idea of reality shopping, where people get their own reality. Arguably, people get one reality from Fox News and another reality from MSNBC. So how does a citizen navigate through this?
Well, that's a great question, and it really goes to the heart of the larger theme in my book. And by the way, I'm glad to be joining you today. But it really focuses on when you look at how things went so badly off course for this White House, it goes back to the overall culture in Washington, which is based on this Washington game of spin and political manipulation and zero-sum politics. And too often, the national media becomes complicit in furthering this Washington game where truth really takes a backseat to who is most effectively winning the media narrative of the day. And so I think there's certainly many more outlets for people to get their information today, and those with their own preconceived views of things can certainly reinforce those own preconceived views if they go into it with that sort of attitude. But fortunately, there are a lot of programs like yours that look deeper and try to get to the broader truth of things, look at what's right and wrong versus what's necessarily who's winning and who's losing and who's up and who's down. And that's too often what happens in Washington today. The truth gets lost because it's not focusing on substance. It's focusing on lionizing those who most effectively play the game to their advantage.
Well, nobody's been more lionized than Karl Rove. Indeed, during the 2004 campaign, I recall a lot of Democrats wistfully asking themselves, where is our Karl Rove? So has he set a standard, if you will?
Well, there certainly is. The permanent campaign wasn't created by the permanent campaign culture in Washington, wasn't created by the likes of Karl Rove, but it certainly created people like Karl Rove. I mean, Democrats have certainly had theirs, similar people in that vein, like James Carville and others, that come at it from a different ideological perspective. But Karl Rove is certainly someone who has taken the permanent campaign culture to a new level in his own right, and was an instrumental player in this White House, and that's one of the concerns I have about Washington today and the White House today is that there's too much reliance on the political side of things versus getting back to governing based on deliberation and compromise, as opposed to trying to constantly manipulate the media narrative to your advantage as the primary means for governing. And that's something I go into great detail exploring in the book as I'm talking about the events as I live them from inside the White House. But Karl Rove had enormous influence on this president, too much influence in my view, and it negatively influenced his presidency in the long run. It might have helped get him reelected, but I think it has hurt his legacy in the long term.
And of course, FDR once said that there are two kinds of people in politics, those that help you get elected and those that help you govern, and that the twain should not meet. In your book, you describe being in the Oval Office when President Bush is having his conversation with John Kerry after accepting John Kerry's defeat and
right.
concession. And I'm curious, though, what happened there, because I recall the press conference where he said, I've got some political capital, I'm going to spend it. But very little was accomplished, and it's very strange. And a lot of, perhaps I'm getting Oedipal here, but I've heard people suggest that the president, in a sense, once he'd been reelected, he had passed one of the highest bars that he set for himself, which is to do better than his father did. So did he sort of put his feet up on the table after that?
Well, I think there's probably a little bit of that. There's absolutely, you touched on something very important there when you talk about his father. And I think one of the wrong lessons the president learned from his father's time in office was that, you remember his father, certainly in the 1988 campaign, used some of the more unsavory political tactics to defeat Michael Dukakis. It was an accentuate the negative campaign. But then when he got into office, he was a much more civil in his governance. He believed in reaching out and working with Democrats. And the bitterness, though, from that campaign didn't end there, and he got defeated for reelect precisely because he tried to shun some of those things that he had embraced during the campaigning while he was governing. And I think the president took that and said, you know what, my father didn't play the game the way it's played. I'm going to play it the way it's played under the existing rules, and I'm going to make sure I get reelected. And so he embraced too much of the political side in order to get reelected. And then once we did, yes, he overreached again. I mean, he thought that he had, you know, was portrayed as some sort of mandate when it was actually a very close election, and immediately tried to tackle the issue of Social Security, but was only willing to compromise so much. He laid down some tough markers there that there had to be private retirement accounts within part of the solution instead of genuine compromise. And in the meantime, Iraq was getting worse and worse. The violence was increasing. We were moving toward a civil war there. And, that side of things was probably neglected more than it should have been. And so, yes, I think there is some truth to what you say about kind of kicking back and putting his feet up on the table. He had accomplished what his father couldn't. And when you get that second term, you have a chance to achieve a lasting legacy. And unfortunately, I think he overreached in some of those regards.
But Scott McClellan, you mentioned he didn't really get a great mandate. He was very close in the Electoral College, 3.5 million ahead in the popular vote. But in the first election, 2000, of course, he was minus 560,000 in the popular, and won by 537 votes in the Electoral College. What happened there in terms of a mandate? Obviously, the mandate came with 9/11, it seems, and there's a lot of disappointment. I detect some of it in your book about the president who ran and the president who became this divisive figure. I don't know whether you saw on C-SPAN the hearings that took place this week in the Congress on impeachment, but the bitterness towards this president is palpable in some quarters in this country.
Absolutely. I did not see the hearings. I certainly followed it. I saw some of the news coverage of it. But the reason that bitterness is there, the responsibility lies with this president, because he has left so much suspicion there among many people in the electorate because of his own actions. This is an administration that is not very open with the public, and I think that's to his detriment. It is an administration that has embraced too much of the unsavory side of politics, from spin and manipulation to other things, and there's a lot of questions there that this administration has refused to address head-on or refused to address substantively. In Congress certainly has an important oversight role to play, and when it was controlled by Republicans, They did not exercise that oversight role very strongly. Now Democrats, since 2006, have decided to re-exert that important responsibility that they play. And I would welcome it if more administration officials would be willing to come forth and testify and talk about these issues. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen under this White House in the remaining months in office. And so there are going to be a lot of questions left among the electorate about these issues, the issues that were raised about the lead-up to the war, the issues relating to detention or detainee policies, and so forth. And the only reason that that suspicion is there is because this administration has not been very open with the public about things.
And, of course, Karl Rove will resist the subpoena, which will probably eventually have to be fought out up to the Supreme Court. And perhaps by the time they get any resolution of that, the president's tenure might well be over. But give us a sense of much of these hearings we've been hearing, particularly about Guantanamo. The fingerprints of Dick Cheney are pretty clear there. What was the division there in that White House? It's a pervasive idea that, to some extent, the president outsourced his presidency to his vice president.
Yeah, and I think in that regard, that's one good example of it. You know, the president bears responsibility for what has happened because he's the one that ultimately makes the decisions. But he has been extremely deferential to the vice president and delegated to him in a number of areas, whether it was energy policy at the beginning of the administration or detainee policy after 9/11. He allowed the vice president to kind of be the point person on those issues and decide how to go about implementing those policies and deferred to his judgment in those matters. And we now know that the vice president was very integral in running meetings to set that detainee policy that has led to a lot of questions, whether it's waterboarding or other harsh interrogation methods that have been used. And there are a lot of questions that remain about exactly what was authorized and who was involved in what. And, you know, we're not going to get any, you're right, in the remaining months of this presidency, it's going to be more stonewalling and trying to drag things out, and then the administration will be over. And the hope is that the next Congress won't take a look at these issues any deeper, that they would have run the clock out. You know, I think that these are important truths that the American people need to have a full understanding of for our future's sake, if nothing else, so that we can learn not to allow some of these mistakes to be repeated.
And in the sense that there's been a tug of war going on within this president's own administration, is he having some second thoughts here about the extent to which Dick Cheney had too much of a free hand? I mean, you get the feeling that this flurry of diplomacy is related to the need for some kind of legacy, which I think, even though we're early in the day, I think you can fairly say that the historians will look upon Dick Cheney as having tainted Bush's presidency.
Oh, and I would agree, and I think that comes across in the book in my writings that he has been more of a negative influence than a positive influence. When you know, he was first selected, everybody thought it was a very shrewd choice and a good choice. But you know, a lot of people today in Washington say this isn't the Dick Cheney I knew back in the 1970s or back in Congress. It's a different person. But the president has in the final months here started to shift in a number of ways on foreign policy, whether it's Iran or North Korea or Iraq. You've seen some subtle shifts and more of a willingness to compromise, not only on foreign policy, but domestic policy. And I think that is a recognition that if he doesn't do any of that, there's not much he is going to get done at all here in the remaining months, and that these are issues that are going to reflect on his legacy, and he wants to try to do something with his remaining time in office to maybe influence that. You know, we don't know how things are going to turn out 30, 40, 50 years from now in Iraq and what or how people review his legacy. But it doesn't change what I wrote in the book. He could have been a lot more successful if we had been more open and candid about things, and if he had been more willing to, or if there had been advisors around him that had a more diverse set of viewpoints that were willing to question some of those that kept pushing him in a certain direction, namely to go in and invade Iraq under pretenses that were you know, false at best.
So was there anybody there that, you know, I know Brent Scowcroft and a lot of those people from early administrations, and they always wanted input from people like me that are on the political left. Was there anybody in the entire Bush experience of in these last 7 years that ever gave a contrary view?
Well, certainly Colin Powell was one of those, and I saw it at times in small settings in the Oval Office, and he'd willingly express his view, and it might be at odds with others, but at the end of the day, he recognized that the president's the one that makes the decisions, and he was the loyal soldier in the sense that once that decision was made, he would do what he needed to do to help the president implement that decision. But it was too far and few between in terms of those that were questioning things. I think that Secretary Rice, is probably better suited at the State Department than she was as National Security Advisor, where she was too accommodating of the likes of the Vice President, the Secretary of Defense, Secretary Rumsfeld, and others that were more from the neoconservative viewpoint that Paul Wolfowitz and others that were aggressively pushing things in a certain direction and encouraging the president to move forward on some of his gut instincts versus making sure the president had a full understanding of the consequences of some of the decisions that he was making. He often tends to govern from the gut and make a quick decision, and then he expects everybody to march in lockstep once that decision is made. Well, we should have been questioning that decision before more, and we should have probably been critiquing it even afterwards and questioning whether or not it was the right policy to continue.
Well, indeed, up against Dick Cheney and the Secretary of Defense almost tag-teaming,
right.
Condoleezza Rice was wilted. But clearly, it seems to me, just in closing, it seems in the mechanics of the situation were that Dick Cheney always had the last bite of the apple.
Well, certainly on certain issues, I think he very much did so. Whether it was energy and some economic issues or foreign policy, he made his views known very privately with the president, kept things close to the vest. But he certainly had his ear and had plenty of time to express those views to him one-on-one, and in many ways got what he wanted on those issues.
Well, I wish we had more time. I'm sorry we've run out of time. There's an awful lot more to talk about in your book and from your experience, Scott McClellan, what happened inside the Bush White House and Washington's culture of deception. Thank you for joining us.
Ian, thanks for having me on.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Scott McClellan, who served as the White House press secretary from 2003 to 2006. He is the author of a new book, What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. I'm now speaking with Tim Shorrock, who is an independent journalist who's written for a long list of magazines and newspapers, including Mother Jones, The Progressive, The Nation, Harper's, and others. His new book, Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. And, of course, we've heard so much about the outsourcing of the military, the extent to which Halliburton has been one of the main beneficiaries of this administration's priorities in spending, but very little about the outsourcing of intelligence. Clearly, this could be an extremely scary world, couldn't it, if spies for hire, either for the government, making, it's almost like the dream that Oliver North talked about in the Iran-Contra testimony about this independent off-the-shelf operation that you could use without legal consequences. Is this a reality?
I think we're getting pretty close to that reality, yes. Right now, about 70%, that's 70% of the intelligence budget is spent on private contracts, and that can go to everything from, staples and pencils to satellites. But it covers a wide range of things, including, CIA covert operations. They hire quite a few contractors. We know from particularly a recent book by Jane Meyer on Bush's intelligence policies that independent contractors have been used extensively by the CIA in the interrogation of prisoners in Guantanamo and elsewhere. But contractors are all over the intelligence community. National Security Agency, maybe 50 to 60% of the staffers there are actually working for private corporations doing analysis of signals intelligence and telephone conversations. So it's a very big operation.
Well, there's an interesting movie. It didn't get seen a lot, but it was actually a very good movie with George Clooney where you have a group of intelligence people that clearly come out of the intelligence world, but they're being hired by a private corporation to get rid of a troublesome lawyer in the midst of a delicate lawsuit, and they basically assassinate this guy. And it was very chilling because it opened up to my mind the possibility that this is a very real possibility and this would be an easy line to cross.
Well, what I find most disturbing is the lack of accountability. You know, intelligence itself, the budgets are kept classified, the aggregate spending we do on intelligence is kept classified by the government, except for rare instances where they'll tell us, you know, how much they spent in 1 year. But by and large, they keep these numbers secret, and these intelligence contracts that I was talking about, CIA, NSA, many other agencies, for the most part, probably about 80% of them are classified and they're secret. And so there are very few people within government that can see these contracts from beginning to end and see exactly what happened from the bidding part to the end of the contract, if there is an end of the contract. Many of these are open-ended. But the problem is accountability. And we saw this in Abu Ghraib where, you know, there were reports of military investigations of the abuse of prisoners that went on in Abu Ghraib, and two companies were named in the original investigations, and names of those individuals were passed over to federal prosecutors, but there was never any prosecution of intelligence contractors that were involved there. And I think that points to a much greater problem of accountability and having, you know, these people accountable both to law and what is the chain of command and how do they fit in? It's very unclear and very murky area.
The film that I was trying to think of was Michael Clayton. I don't know whether you saw it. But
I did see that,
It's a really chilling scene where they get rid of this troublesome lawyer. And it doesn't seem to me to be that fictional. The Carlyle Group, of which the president's father, George Herbert Walker Bush, is one of the, I think one of the partners, or at least he's one of, he certainly
used to be.
Used to be.
Yeah.
They've bought up the biggest intelligence outsourcing outfit, Booz Hamilton, right?
Booz Allen Hamilton.
Yeah.
Which is, as I write in my book, Spies for Hire, it's a very major intelligence contractor, not just in the sense of, you know, how many contracts it has, but in the very high level of intelligence that it's involved with. Booz Allen Hamilton has this long history of being a sort of a management consulting company to major industrial corporations. But since World War II, it was very involved in defense consulting and working with various agencies of the Department of Defense and the Pentagon. And since about the 70s or 80s, it started going heavily into intelligence. Listeners, of course, should know and understand that 85% of the intelligence budget comes through the Department of Defense. And many of the agencies, such as the National Security Agency, fall under the command and control system of the Department of Defense. So Booz Allen has been an advisor to the Department of Defense for a long time. And now it advises the National Security Agency, the Office of Director of National Intelligence, and many of the large collection agencies. And so it has a very big stake in this. And in fact, the current director of National Intelligence, Michael McConnell, actually just before he was named to his current position, served for the last 12 years as Director of Military Intelligence for Booz Allen Hamilton. So the private and public sectors are very closely intertwined, and as I've written in the book and elsewhere, a lot of top intelligence officials have gone into this industry, such as George Tenet, the former CIA director. He doesn't mention this at all in his book about intelligence and about the war on terror, but he has I actually was able to pin down in 2006, he made about $3 million himself as an advisor or as a director to intelligence contractors, and these include some of the biggest names in the business.
Well, of course, Kofa Black became head of intelligence for Blackwater, and he poached the CIA station chief in Jordan, and Jordan is a country that's always essentially been propped up by the CIA. And that leads you to wonder now that they've almost privatized the government's relationship with a key country in a very strategic situation there in the Middle East. One of the arguments you can make about the Iraq War is that it appears to be a war that's fought in the corporate interest and not in the national interest, the extent to which it's going to be a continuing disaster in spite of all this nonsense about the surges working and all this stuff. At the end of the day, it's going to be a catastrophe no matter which way you look at it. But at the end of the day, you have to say, well, the country lost out, but Halliburton certainly didn't.
Yeah, I have this chapter in my book called The Pure Plays, and it's about companies. It's kind of a Wall Street term that refers to companies that make, a majority of their income, in this case 70 to 80%, from intelligence and defense intelligence. And there's quite a number of companies that fall into this. And I covered several investment conferences where some of these companies, presented to their investors and pitched their company as a good place to put their money, and they talked about what they did. And what's really amazing is how much information actually comes out about intelligence in these forums, exactly what they're doing is quite extensive. I have a lot in there in the book about, for example, when we look at the National Security Agency and the eavesdropping program, the warrantless surveillance program that's been in the news lately. Well. It's not only telecom companies that cooperated with the NSA. There's very high-level companies in the information technology business that helps analyze these calls. And I argue very strongly in the book that, when we talk about the whole, intelligence industrial complex, we need to include not only the telecoms but all these other information technology companies such as Booz Allen Hamilton. But what really struck me in covering those intelligence briefings was there was one point where I went to one in around, I think it was 2006, and the war in Iraq was just, horrendous. There was, hundreds of people being killed almost every day. Yet these companies were just saying what a great business it was, and it was just terrific that they were getting all these contracts. And, business was good. People were dying, but business was very good. So that's sort of the anomaly we have here.
Well, Tim Shurek, let's talk about a subject that I remember covering years and years ago. I spoke with the people that created this software Promise for a company, Inslaw, and they got aced out by a shadowy figure connected to the Reagan administration, I recall. Apparently it was an early and interesting technology that had some of the characteristics of Google and other search engines well before anybody knew about this, and was able to put a lot of data together. And you trace that story of Promise Software and Inslaw all the way through to all of this stuff that's come out now about the National Security Agency, wiretaps, and also this thing called Main Core. Mm-hmm. So just walk us through, if you could, very briefly, that logic trail.
Okay, well, this story appeared in Salon a couple of days ago, and I was talking about it in the context of the possibility of another church committee to investigate intelligence abuse, and I used that news peg as sort of a way to look at some things that I think should be investigated and issues that I had reported on in recent months, and one of these was this whole issue of Promise and Main Core. Inslaw has been in this long-involved fight with the Justice Department and the U.S. government over its claims, which are quite credible claims. They've gone through a number of courts and actually have been investigated in Congress, that they claim that the Justice Department essentially stole their software, which was before Google, which had a very strong capability to search, and also they could search through all kinds of case files like Google does and just come up with the top items, the things that a searcher would be most interested in. It also searches databases, and they claim that the government stole this software and then gave it to the CIA and the NSA to monitor their own intelligence investigations using this software. And that it's never quite been resolved, but in talking to the people that run the company and the people that they've hired to investigate these charges, and also talking to some people who have long experience in intelligence, I was able to report that there's very credible evidence that this software, this Promise Search software, is used by the government to search a very large database that's been in place for some time, a database that lists domestic, you know, people within the United States who are considered national security threats. And that threat could fall into any, you know, any number of categories. But according to another article that was in Radar, there was like about 8 million names in this. This dates back to the early 80s when the Reagan administration started something called the Continuity of Government Program, which was a top-secret program to create a government in case the government, in case the country came under a nuclear attack. And there was a database that would be used as part of that sort of, you know, continuity in government to keep track of people who might be dangerous in a situation like that. And news articles have cropped up over the years. In fact, Oliver North was questioned about this database during the Iran-Contra hearings because some Congress people believe that they might be using this database as a way to, at that time, to keep track of people opposed to the U.S. war in Central America. Well, turns out that that database, according to people I've spoken to, is still in place, and it's supposed to be used only in a time of martial law, only in a case of national emergency. But I've been told that the NSA may have been given permission to use this domestic database as a way to follow up on intercepts that had picked up in Afghanistan and Iraq, or, well, actually Afghanistan right after 9/11. Say they'd get, you know, telephone numbers from a computer or laptop in Afghanistan, or somebody would tell them a name, and they'd put those numbers and the names into this domestic database and look for relationships and perhaps use it as a way to do surveillance of Americans here. And what concerned people is the mixture of a database that's created for a national emergency, for a martial law, with surveillance that's supposed to be aimed at foreign targets, not Americans.
Well, obviously, there's still a lot to be learned, and unfortunately, the Senate and a lot of the Democrats rolled over and gave Bush and Cheney a get-out-of-jail-free pass and the phone company's immunity. And we don't know what it is that Jim Comey, the acting attorney general and the head of the FBI, were prepared to resign over.
No, we don't. And, but we do know that it may have been to do with databases
exactly.
That include thousands and thousands of American names and telephone numbers.
Well, I'm sorry you've run out of time, Tim Shorrock. I thank you so much for joining us, and we should talk again, particularly about your book, Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking there with Jim Shorrock, who's an independent journalist, and he's got some articles that are worth looking at on Salon.com, and of course his new book is Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Let's now go to the subject of diplomacy breaking out all over. I'm speaking with Ambassador Charles Freeman, who's a former United States Ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He was also been Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, a distinguished fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies, and the Director of Chinese Affairs for the Department of State, among other positions. He also served as an advisor on the Iraq Study Group. And last time we spoke, Ambassador Freeman, you suggested that whereas Iran has a successful political occupation of Iraq, the United States has a unsuccessful military occupation. Do you think that has changed in the... Certainly, Senator McCain seems to be the foundation of his presidential campaign, that indeed things have changed, and it's all because of the surge.
Well, I don't agree with that. I think, yes, things have changed in Iraq. Things change all the time under conditions of strife. Several things changed before the beginning of the surge. The so-called Anbar Awakening, or Sahwa, I think largely catalyzed by Saudi Arabian covert action, turned the Sunni tribesmen in Anbar successfully against al-Qaeda, and we had the wit and wisdom to take advantage of that, which is much to the credit of General Petraeus. But it had nothing to do with the surge. The surge in Baghdad essentially oversaw the completion of a process of ethnic cleaning or separation, by which Baghdad was turned into a series of small walled communities with the U.S. soldiers patrolling the borders and local militias enforcing peace and keeping intruders out. And so the level of mayhem went down because essentially people had been separated from each other. But there's been no fundamental progress on the establishment of a viable political order in Iraq that can stand without our presence. And indeed, we are now apparently an essential prop of the existing order. And the fear is that were we to leave, there would be a resumption of even greater violence than there currently is. So the argument things have improved is belied by the fact that the same people argue that we can't afford to leave, because if we do, Iraq will fall into chaos.
So the Saudi covert action was, I guess, was combined with the United States checkbook. I mean, it seems to me what's happening here, we're paying the people who were shooting us.
Well, I think the Saudis did what they did on their own for their own good reasons, which had to do with gaining some counters to the Iranians, among others, and putting their ore into Iraqi politics, as well as defending themselves against al-Qaeda, which, after all, is focused principally on them. But yes, we've emulated them, and we have essentially bought the, or more accurately, probably rented the quiescence and cooperation of many of the people who were formerly insurgents. And I suppose they will stay rented as long as the money continues to flow. What would happen after that, no one knows.
So if indeed this is a tenuous situation dependent upon the U.S. staying, and obviously it's almost as though the two presidential candidates are in competition about when we'll leave, not if. And so if indeed that happens within a year or 2 years or whatever the timetable eventually is, is your expectation then that the parties inside Iraq itself are going to duke it out?
Well, that's very likely, I think. What has changed most notably is that the Nouri al-Maliki government, whether on its own bat or in response to discussion with Iran, to which it is beholden, has decided that it wants a timetable for U.S. Withdrawal to be put in place. And that implies that it believes it's strong enough to survive the aftermath of U.S. Withdrawal. Whether it has assurances of Iranian support in that regard or not, we don't know.
Well, indeed, you just mentioned Saudi Arabia acting on its own because the United States had unwittingly emboldened, strengthened Iran, essentially the winner in our intervention in Iraq. Obviously, there's a lot of dialogue going on now over the Iranian nuclear program. The Iranians have just announced that they have 5,000 centrifuges, which is, I think, enough to start, if they're capable of doing so, enriching uranium for making nuclear weapons. And that seems to be of great concern to the Israelis. There was an op-ed recently in the New York Times by Israeli historian Benny Morris suggesting in a peculiar way that the Israelis may well be doing the Iranian people a favor by preemptively destroying the Iranian nuclear program, because if they don't do that, inevitably, there will be a nuclear war. So this is the better of those two choices. Do you see this as inexorable, some kind of strike on Iran's nuclear facilities?
Absolutely not, because I don't think the Israelis, in fact, have the capability to deal effectively with the Iranian nuclear program, which is widely dispersed and protected from airstrikes. The Israeli Air Force would be operating at the end of a very long tether, and it couldn't sustain the kind of campaign that would be required to do serious damage of a lasting nature to the Iranian program. Furthermore, it seems that the Israeli threats to attack Iran are more in the nature of a sort of blackmail of the United States, that if we don't do it for them, they will do something which makes very little sense themselves, and in the hope of dragging us into a wider war with Iran. Nobody in the region is at all enthusiastic. In fact, all are quite fearful about this. The most the calmest about it seem to be the Iranians. I guess they judge that it's not very likely. And so we are left in a position where we have begun to have some contact with the Iranians, but there's no indication that the basic message we've been sending them, which is the five-part message, one, you're evil, which is a wonderful way to start a conversation. Two, we won't talk to you until you come out with your hands up. Three, whatever you do, we plan to overthrow your regime, and if you don't believe that, look at all the money that Congress has appropriated for the purpose. Four, if you don't cooperate with the diplomatic approach that I've just outlined, if it can be called that, we're very likely to bomb you. And five, if you try to develop a deterrent against our doing that, we shall certainly bomb you, possibly with nuclear weapons. And the net result of this sort of approach, which is anything but diplomacy, it's a series of ultimata and threats with no incentive for the Iranians to cooperate, has probably been to deepen their resolve to build a nuclear weapon. I think that they may have suspended the bomb-building program per se because it doesn't make sense to pursue that until they've got the fissile material and the delivery systems worked out. And they seem to be focusing, as the 5,000 centrifuges suggest, on those tasks and deferring the bomb building, which isn't a terribly difficult task, to a later day. That isn't very encouraging, but I don't think Israel's in a position to stop it.
Well, allegedly they have the an advanced design that AQ Khan provided them with, so that may well be the case, that they're ready to go, but they haven't got the fissile material. So what is the solution then? I mean, I guess the Israeli position is based upon the assumption that deterrence doesn't work with the mullahs.
Well, I think there's absolutely no basis for that assumption. Iran is long on revolutionary rhetoric, but extraordinarily pragmatic and realistic in its approach to foreign affairs and to events in the region. And I think it's positively psychotic to take the sort of statements that Ahmadinejad has made essentially as a political poseur, seeking favor from the Arab and Persian masses by denouncing the existence of Israel, as any indication of a national intention on the part of Iran to actually do anything about the existence of Israel, which seems to be fairly well entrenched at the present time. So we're dealing with a situation in which the New York Times op-ed piece that you mentioned by an Israeli historian and strategist employed circular reasoning. If Iran doesn't give up its nuclear weapon, there will be a nuclear war because Israel will be obliged to start one. Well, there are alternatives to that, and they exist everywhere else in the world, and that is nuclear balance and deterrence. And there's every reason to believe, as I say, that deterrence will work because the Iranians in practice have proven to be quite cautious and realistic.
Well, wouldn't just short of some preemptive action on the part of the Israelis, a possession of a nuclear weapon on the part of the Iranians, wouldn't that propel the Saudis to want to get one? I mean, there is the proliferation angle, which we should all be concerned about, and therefore
I think we should be concerned about proliferation. But in a sense, when Israel made the decision to introduce nuclear weapons to the region, which I think was a very foolish decision for a very small country that couldn't survive a nuclear strike on its own, it set in motion forces which lead virtually inevitably to proliferation. That began with the Iraqi nuclear program, which threatened Iran also. both Iraq and Israel share the distinction of having threatened nuclear attack on Iran. It's not surprising the Iranians now have a program. If they develop a nuclear weapon, one can be assured that there will be a major market for Pakistan's nuclear umbrella to be extended into the Middle East, and that the Saudis will hire a Pakistani nuclear garrison to provide the services to them that we provided to Germany during the Cold War. So, yes, the consequences are not good. But unfortunately, I don't think there's much to be done about them. Certainly, they're not going to be forced to go away by issuing nuclear attack threats and avoiding any use of diplomacy at all. It is possible to persuade countries to give up their nuclear programs if you reason with them compellingly. That has been the case with South Africa, which actually had nuclear weapons. It was the case with Argentina and Brazil, which had active nuclear programs. It may yet be the case with North Korea. There's been no effort whatsoever to apply that sort of approach, at least not on the part of the United States, to Iran.
Well, most of the security people that I've spoken to in Washington suggest that much of this nuclear saber-rattling on the part of the Israelis and the extent to which they would like to get the United States in on this, and it's obviously clear that the United States controls the airspace between Israel and Iran, that essentially this is all what they call a PSYOP, a psychological operation, the stick that apparently there's some carrot there somewhere, and I guess that in terms of these six-party talks. But the downside, when I suggested, well, you know, it's not as if we haven't made some blunders in that part of the world, so I don't think you can take the possibility entirely off the table of massive foolishness on the part of some of these actors. But the consequences were made really clear to me were, one, that the United States position in Iraq would become untenable because the Iranians have a massive ability at asymmetrical warfare, and we're vulnerable in Iraq. And two, I think more to the point, that Pakistan itself is sort of hanging by a thread, and that would just tip them over the edge. Anti-Americanism apparently is already pretty deep there. What's your feeling about how tenuous Pakistan is, short of some foolish provocation like a nuclear attack on Iran?
Well, I think the problem of an attack on Iran is obvious, and that is that it won't cause Iran to go away. Persia has been around for a long time, and it will be around in the future as well. But it will ignite an orgy of Muslim rage, not just on the part of Shiites in Iraq and Shiite minorities elsewhere in India and Pakistan and in the Gulf, but on the part of Sunnis, because in the end the distinctions between the two disappear in the face of an enemy of Islam, as they would see it. And Pakistan is indeed poised on the edge of some sort of political cataclysm. This would indeed be the sort of event that could push it over the edge. The other issue, however, is that, as you suggested, the United States controls the airspace in Iraq. We also operate from bases that have been loaned to us by friends in the Gulf, in Qatar, for example, in Kuwait, in the UAE, in Oman, in Bahrain, no longer in Saudi Arabia. But we can't use those bases without overflight of Saudi Arabia. And if Israel were to attack Iraq, possibly with refueling facilitated by us, or if we were ourselves to be drawn into a battle with Iran, then we would find very quickly that the Iranians retaliated fiercely against all of the Gulf states, which could not escape a charge of complicity in our action, since we couldn't carry out the action without a measure of acquiescence, if not cooperation on their part. And I think the Iranians have already told them in no uncertain terms that if this sort of scenario unfolds, they are toast. So the implications are very widespread. I think this could cost us our entire position in the Middle East and jeopardize the Iraq operation in a possibly fatal way, as well as Afghanistan. So it's not a trivial matter.
Well, just turning then to, in the end of this conversation, Ambassador Chad Freeman, to the portent or the appearance of diplomacy being revived. I think you mentioned the other day that dialogue is breaking out all over. are you encouraged in any way since we've had such a pessimistic discussion so far?
Well, I'm not. I find it fascinating and even moderately encouraging that in its very last days, the Bush administration should be discovering the merits of actually talking to people as opposed to assuming that they know what we want and that we understand them despite the absence of contact with them. I think that's very good. I think it's clear that whoever's elected in the fall, this return to diplomacy is likely to prove a long-term trend, and that is very encouraging. Because in the end, the use of force and the threat to use force has very grave limitations in terms of what it can accomplish. And there really is no substitute for convincing people to do things our way by convincing them that it's in their interest to do that. On those few occasions when the Bush administration has attempted this, the results have been not bad. One can think of Libya as an example. And the still unfinished story of North Korea also bears on this. So I am encouraged.
But it does seem, though, that we've shot ourselves in the foot in terms of taking, literally taking the moral high ground from under ourselves in terms of, for example, the torture issue. You get the impression, for example, when Ahmadinejad spoke to the UN last year, he railed against the United States as a nation of torturers, Mugabe, the Burmese junta, these kind of people. It's difficult to deal with them from the position that we normally did deal with them from now because they throw it back at us. Now you have an example where something could, in fact, be done to this genocide, as the United States has called it, in Darfur on the part of the Sudanese, who have clearly been playing us for a long time. Now he's Bashir is about to be indicted by the International Criminal Court. It's a moment of maximum leverage now that we have, perhaps, to stop that bloodletting. But we are not signatories to the International Criminal Court. So are we shooting ourselves in the foot in terms of not being able to exploit this kind of leverage?
Well, I'm not sure in Darfur that I agree that we gain much leverage from an unenforceable court order that may well have the result of making peacekeeping operations impossible in Sudan. But more generally, it's clear that both candidates in this election are determined to end torture and close Guantanamo. So I think measure of restoration of the good name of the United States internationally is very much in prospect. And that is vitally important to the restoration of our influence and our ability to persuade others to do things that we want them to do.
But in terms of these rogue actors, is there any international regime short of, I mean, we've seen how in recent years, since the end of the Cold War, that we have we invaded Panama to arrest one leader. We've had two wars against Iraq to essentially go after one person, but the collateral damage is usually the citizens of these countries. So there has to be a better mechanism with dealing with the Mugabes, and we had that recent incident with Burma where people were talking about even forcing a humanitarian intervention. Where are we in terms of a regime that can go after the bad guys without punishing their victims, which are the unfortunate citizens of these countries that are run by thugs?
We need such a regime, but we aren't going to get it by ignoring the United Nations when we think it's convenient to ignore it and extolling its virtues and its power when we think that is expedient. And that's precisely what we've done. We're also not going to deal effectively with these essentially local and regional problems if we ignore the views of neighbors and regional organizations that are dealing with them. And that is why the action in The Hague against Omar Bashir, which has now been objected to strenuously by the Arab League as well as by the African Union, is very unlikely to prove helpful. We have to take a holistic approach, and that involves persuading people who are close to the events and who have a direct stake in their outcome to see things our way. See, in the case of Zimbabwe, that the failure to engage South Africa and Thabo Mbeki and to enlist him on the right side certainly has prolonged the agony in that country, although I think he has now begun somewhat to redeem himself. So there are lessons here to be drawn, which are that unilateralism, even if it invokes the name of the United Nations, doesn't work. And you need support on the ground. All politics is local, so is all diplomacy.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and discussing some of these sort of larger points, which I regret to say I haven't noticed in the presidential campaign.
Well, there's not much of substance going on there. Maybe one can always hope.
I thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who was the United States Ambassador to Saudi Arabia, has also been the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, a distinguished fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies, and Director of Chinese Affairs at the Department of State, among other positions. He also served as an advisor on the Iraq Study Group. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Lick Duan, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program, of course, is available at ianmasters.org. All archives are there.